You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
The mad violence of war-making that has devastated Iraq and Afghanistan made its second return voyage back to the United States, this time to the world's largest military base in Fort Hood, Texas. Whether it will be better understood on this second return than it was on the first when it struck New York remains to be seen. Meanwhile, President Obama contemplates sending ever more troops to Afghanistan while maintaining all those now in Iraq. In the studio with me to discuss the current situation in Afghanistan, I'm joined by Derek O'Keefe. Derek is an activist with StopWar.ca and has co-written with Afghan feminist Malalai Joya the just-published book, A Woman Among Warlords. Good morning, Derek, and it's great to have you back on Red Eye.
Good morning, Mordecai. Always great to be here.
The protracted and indisputably farcical presidential election has now come to an end with the declaration of Hamid Karzai as winner. Why did NATO put so much effort into this election?
Well, the myth that they've brought democracy in Afghanistan has always been, I guess, central to making their publics, who have been very wary about war making, go along with the Afghan mission, as our media and army is fond of calling it here, a mission rather than a war or an occupation. And I think they were increasingly frustrated with Karzai, and there were a number of trial balloons earlier in 2009, throwing out names of possible replacements. Ashraf Ghani was one. He ended up finishing way back in the elections. Abdullah was another. So they were vetting these possible replacements for Karzai, and in the end, he's still their man in Kabul, and he's been proven to be a puppet, but he's an increasingly illegitimate one. So, and they were very, I think, upset with how blatantly the election was stolen, and obviously they had hopes that a runoff could give a little of a sheen of legitimacy to the election process. And Abdullah, I think, for maybe some of his own reasons, decided to pull out of that process, and has left the situation a little embarrassing, to say the least. For the NATO countries.
So with what seems then, from what you're saying, a failure to burnish the image of bringing democracy to Afghanistan, in fact, just reinforcing corruption, now they've been publicly reprimanding Karzai, and Karzai's responded indignantly, telling them they're interfering in the internal affairs of an independent country.
Well, I mean, Karzai wouldn't have ever been the president of Afghanistan without his foreign backers. And so he's always had to play this game a little bit, particularly as the occupation has become more hated by the Afghan people. So one of the things that annoyed the United States administration, both of them, was that over the past 2 years, increasingly after bombings, NATO bombings where civilians were killed, Karzai would make quite, strong rhetorical statements, call for investigations, call on NATO to stop killing civilians, and so forth. Karzai did this, I believe, the night Obama was elected, or the next day there was a massacre of a wedding party in southern Afghanistan, and Karzai came out very strongly demanding an apology from the incoming administration on this. So he's been an annoyance in that sense too, but he's had to make these rhetorical statements to maintain what little credibility he has, which is evidently very little right now.
We often refer to it, and I refer to it as a war in Afghanistan, but really it's an ever-widening war. Could you tell us a little bit about how this disaster is spreading beyond the borders of Afghanistan itself?
Yes, I think it is important to understand Afghanistan as part of the larger war on terror and part of, quote-unquote, and part of the larger U.S. strategy in the Middle East and Central Asia. That really goes, at least from Palestine to Afghanistan and beyond into South Asia and Pakistan and India as well. So the idea that Afghanistan was somehow separate or a good war, whereas Iraq was this mistake or this bad war, has really been a wrong-headed way of looking at things all along. And yes, it's true, the war has expanded eastward into Pakistan. And it shows no signs of letting up. Basically, as the U.S. has failed and instability in Afghanistan has increased, they're now sowing more instability in Pakistan. So, you know, they claim that Al-Qaeda and Taliban leadership has moved on to Pakistan. And so they're bombing with drones there. They're creating an incredible amount of instability in Pakistan, calling on the regime in Islamabad to take their own repressive measures against the so-called Pakistan Taliban and other forces there. So they're causing a lot of instability, and they have plans to stay for a long time in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's not reported widely, but they have plans to build massive embassy compounds like the one in Baghdad, in both Kabul and Islamabad. So, you know, this is a very, very long-term perspective they had. And it has a lot to do, I think, with the historic role of Pakistan and the historic conflicts as well with Pakistan and India and some geopolitical realignments. Traditionally, India was more closely aligned with the Soviet Union, and since the end of the Cold War, India more and more has become, I think, aligned economically and militarily and politically with the U.S., and also there are a lot of links between the Indian government and the Israeli government. So increasingly, you know, Pakistan traditionally played the role as the key U.S. Puppet or ally in South Asia, and I think India plays that role more and more now.
In Britain, public opinion seems to be shifting rather quickly, and even at the government level, there seems to be some division and confusion about their involvement in the wars in that region. Could you tell us a little bit about what's happening in Britain?
Well, I was actually over in Britain in July doing some book events with Malala Joya, and we saw the public opinion change just over the course of July. From the beginning of the month, it was being reported about 50-50. And by the end of the month, which was the July this year, was the bloodiest month for the UK in Afghanistan, public opinion was very clearly turning against British involvement in the occupation. I think part of the reason you're seeing some government ministers, and there's been, you know, leaks, a lot of leaks from government and military officials in Britain opposed to the war and the strategy there, is that they've really been bumbling in trying to sell this war to the British public. I mean, in the summer, they were still, Gordon Brown and everyone was still leading with this justification that if we're not in Afghanistan, we'll immediately have another 7/7 attack. It would immediately lead to more attacks on terrorist attacks in London. So the public just didn't buy this. The public could clearly see the connection that you know, so-called homegrown terrorism or this you know, attack in London in 2005 came as a result of the disastrous UK policy of aligning with the US and going into Iraq, going into Afghanistan. So part of it, I think, was just this inept way they were selling the war. And another big factor is that there is now a GI resistance movement, a resistance movement within the army. I guess we're using U.S. terminology there. But in July, there was the first British active duty British soldier to really speak out, Joe Glendon. He actually spoke at the meeting in London with Malala Joya. This was his first time speaking out. In last week or 2 weeks ago at the large anti-war demonstration in London, he spoke again to a big crowd. And there was a very interesting article, I think this was reported on the BBC and elsewhere, that Joe Glendon, this young soldier, after speaking out, he had to report back. He's still active duty. He had to report back to his barracks, and he said he was very worried about getting beat up or, you know, verbally abused, disciplined, whatever. And when he got back to the barracks, he was literally getting slapped on the back, congratulated. He had, I think he said even some of the officers were telling him, like, way to go. Maybe not. But the reaction was overwhelmingly positive from his fellow soldiers, happy that someone was speaking out against this outrageous war where more and more British soldiers are dying. And I think, you know, we've seen hints of that amongst families of dead Canadian soldiers, the beginnings of dissent. It gets swept away from our media stories very quickly, but I think we will see more and more resistance amongst active soldiers in these wars. And that's very clearly the only part of the U.S. anti-war movement that's growing and vibrant right now, is the GI resistance, and Iraq Veterans Against War is a rapidly growing and influential organization in opposing these wars.
You mentioned in Canada the some glimmers of families of soldiers speaking critically. The Canadian Parliament passed this resolution, of course, saying we're going to keep our troops there till 2011. Now there seems to be all kinds of signals from the government that they're trying to find ways to go and circumvent that. What do you make of this debate in the Canadian Parliament, or maybe not a debate yet, but at least these maneuvers?
Well, we've been completely lacking in an actual debate about Canada's deployment to Afghanistan all along. And since fall 2008, in the last federal election, Stephen Harper sort of preempted whatever timid opposition there would have been from the Liberals, and even the NDP, about the war by saying, okay, at the end of 2011, we're going to pull out. That's final. And he repeated this many times. And so that, I think, effectively, from a political point of view, from Harper and the Conservatives' perspective, that effectively took the war off the table in electoral sense. And unfortunately, we haven't had any strong voices in Parliament saying 2011 is too late, we need to bring the troops home now. The NDP has been relatively quite quiet since the end of 2008, and that's been a big problem. So I think in this atmosphere, the Conservatives feel a little more confident to start, again, putting out trial balloons about extending the Canadian presence in Afghanistan beyond 2011. Or just preparing the public for a bit of a bait and switch. You know, it's quite likely that at the end of 2011, Canadian troops will pull out of Kandahar, and they may find another part of the country to do work in. And a number of people who previously had been fairly clear in calling for the troops to leave Afghanistan have sort of offered their support to some other kind of Canadian involvement, diplomatic or so-called peacekeeping, after the end of 2011. So, you know, we've seen that from people like Steve Staples, I believe, co-wrote an article in the Ottawa Citizen at the time of Obama's visit, sort of suggesting ways that Canada could continue to help the U.S. in Afghanistan after 2011 without having combat troops there. So that kind of argument is really problematic and is something I think the anti-war movement has to really cut through and more sharply demand troops out now. If we look at the disaster there each month, last month was the bloodiest month for NATO soldiers, and you know, also there's still a high level of civilian casualties. So if that's the situation now and it's been getting worse, we can only imagine how many more lives will be lost needlessly in the next 2 years if we don't bring the troops home sooner.
Fortunately, Malalai Joy is making a tour of Canada. She's been going across the United States. She's going to be here in Vancouver a week today at the St. Andrew's Wesley Church for an evening talk. What can people benefit from hearing from her?
I think Malalai is, an essential voice and has been for... She's been well known in Afghanistan and internationally for 5 or 6 years now, ever since she spoke out about the, you know, blatant presence of warlords and war criminals in the post-war government that was set up with Karzai as the figurehead. And I think she's very important at cutting through this notion that somehow, although the situation is bad, if we left, it would be worse. And in particular, it'd be worse for Afghan women. Well, Malalai Joya is very clearly saying, we don't want your so-called help anymore. You have made the situation more and more disastrous. And rather than talking about adding fuel to the fire, adding more troops, the Afghan people want to be left to determine their own future and to deal with their internal enemies on their own. Because right now you have NATO not only bombing from the sky and killing civilians and doing all the all the brutality that comes with an occupation, but they're arming and financing these warlords and these reactionary political forces in Afghanistan. The clearest example recently and most important for Canada is Karzai's brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, who it was revealed in the New York Times a couple weeks ago that he's been an employee of the CIA. And this is, in fact, documented that a lot of the warlords who are in power have received cash right from the beginning in 2001 to sort of buy their allegiance to the occupying powers. And Karzai's brother, it's also well known that he's involved in the drug trade. He's been described as a drug kingpin by a lot of anonymous sources from the U.S. administration. So this is what Canadian soldiers in Kandahar have been killing and dying for, is this most powerful man in Kandahar province, Karzai's brother, a drug-dealing CIA employee. You know, the reality of this situation is so grotesque that I think in some ways the anti-war movement has not been sharp enough in the language we use to describe the situation. And bringing it back to Malala's message, she's always used very, very clear and strong language. She's, you know, the opposite of a mealy-mouthed politician who will moderate their discourse. But, you know, when she was saying 2-3 years ago that Afghanistan had the most corrupt government in the world, you know, maybe we didn't process that. Or and when she described the drug lords and the warlords in power, you know, it's not just rhetoric. Here we have a drug lord, Karzai's brother, in Kandahar province. And yet, this sort of notion that Canada is there building democracy and helping the women is allowed to still have some currency. So her visit is a really important opportunity to cut through this and to revive the anti-war movement a bit, in a sense of being an active campaigning force that, you know, ordinary people see in their day-to-day lives.
Well, thank you for their coming in, and we'll give people the information again about Malala's visit in Vancouver, and she'll be going to other parts of Canada as well, so people should look forward to seeing when she's going to be in their area.
Yeah, she'll be doing a cross-Canada tour until November 27th, so just over 2 weeks, visiting most of the major cities in Canada.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Thank you, Mordecai.
I've been speaking with Derek O'Keefe. He's a longtime activist with StopWar.ca. He's an editor with Rabble, and he has co-written with Afghan feminist Malala Joya the just-published book, A Woman Among Warlords.